Good afternoon, the Arizona Daily Star for Sunday, January 18th, here on Sun Sounds, Mark DeGroft with you. Plans are once again underway to revive the long vacant Hotel Arizona, which is adjacent to the Tucson Convention Center. Dormant since 2012, the downtown hotel at 181 West Broadway will reopen as the 296-room Arizona Hotel HSL Hyatt, a full-service convention hotel plans filed with the City of Tucson show. The existing architecture will remain, and the single-pane glass and aluminum window frames will be replaced with insulated glass and thermal frames, the plans show. The roof of the 53-year-old hotel will also be replaced. A former parking garage to the west of the structure was torn down due to safety concerns, and there will be a driveway on the east side and possibly a housing project, according to developers. A bridge on the east will provide access to the historic Plaza de la Masia and gazebo, also known as La Placita. Interior renovations have also begun with demolition work. New plans are forthcoming, said Omar Morales, who is president of HSL Properties, which owns the hotel. He said about $7 million worth of work has already taken place inside the building to demolish some portions and for asbestos abatement. The Rio Nuevo Board has voted to offer HSL Properties 150 parking spaces in the parking garage, which is near the Linda Ronstadt Music Hall, for 2 years after the construction is complete. After those 24 months, they will be rented to HSL for $15 per space. "We're super excited about the revitalization of the Hotel Arizona," said Edmund Marquez, who's vice chairman of the Rio Nuevo Board. HSL had done a wonderful job of investing in this space to bring something very special to the gateway of downtown. He said hotel rooms adjacent to the TCC would allow the city to attract more events and conventions. "These conventions are a huge boost to our economy and to our tax base," Marquez said. "This is a win-win." The 13-story Hotel Arizona was built in 1973. Developers hope to have the hotel open within the next 2 years, they said during a public presentation to the city planners earlier this month. Previous attempts to reopen Hotel Arizona with financial incentives from the city have been unsuccessful. The project also is delayed because of the pandemic and of rising interest rates, Morales said. Exterior work is expected to begin as early as next month. Hyatt has been very patient with us, he said. The Arizona Auditor General recently issued a report of Rio Nuevo and urged the board to concentrate on bringing more hotel rooms to the downtown area, especially near the Tucson Convention Center. "This is one of the most important characteristics for event planners, as it serves as an indicator of the market's ability to have adequate room blocks available within a close proximity to the event facility," the audit says. Tucson currently has 993 rooms near the Tucson Convention Center. Arizona, California, and Nevada would take a disproportionate share of water use cuts that is being proposed in a new federal environmental report that's aimed at preventing dead pool levels in the Colorado River reservoirs, several experts say. The U.S. Bureau of Reclamation's draft environmental impact statement for the river proposes four new alternative plans for bringing water use in balance with the ever-declining supply. All calls for curbs for the lower and upper Colorado River basins. But the cuts show are much sharper for Arizona and the lower basin states, California and Nevada, in proportion to their total water supplies, than for the upper basin states of Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming. The four proposals would share an average range of 1.48 million to 4 million acre-feet a year of river water supply from the lower basin states, compared to 200,000 to 500,000 acre-feet annually from the upper basin states. Together, the lower basin states have used 6 to 7 million acre-feet of river water annually in recent years, which isn't counting the evaporation that draws another 12 million acre-feet per year. The upper basin states that use about 4.5 million acre-feet a year, a figure that typically includes the evaporation. An acre-foot is enough to serve 4 Tucson homes or 3 Phoenix, Arizona homes for a year. If the lower basin loses 1.48 million acre feet, that would be the equivalent of enough water to serve all of Tucson water customers for 15 years. At the same time, the new report raises the very real possibility that if precipitation and other climate-related conditions on the Colorado Dome improve, none of the proposed alternatives will be able to stabilize the river so that its flows don't decline even more. Battered by a long-term drought and continual warming temperatures, the river's flows have declined roughly 20% since the year 2000 to an average of 12 million or so acre-feet per year. In the past 5 years, that decline has worsened, dropping average annual flows to about 11 million acre-feet annually. The new report comes as seven basin states are deadlocked in conflict over how to apportion the cuts, needed in part to prevent Lakes Mead and Powell from dropping so low as to reach Deadpool when no water could be pulled out of them. More than 2 years of negotiations have brought the states no closer to consensus on a solution. The reclamation report is just one more step down the road to a possibly federal-imposed solution, although Bureau officials and water officials from all the seven states say that's the last thing that they want. Bureau officials hope to develop new guidelines to manage the river's reservoirs once the current rules expire at the end of 2026. But the new report says that developing new guidelines is difficult in this complex basin, where critically low usage and storage on Lake Powell and Lake Mead, significant to hydrologic variability, and the anticipation of drier future conditions amplify the central trade-off, balancing the potentially profound impacts of water delivery reductions with the need to maintain reservoir storage. These alternatives in the draft report capture a broad range of management strategies to address the trade-off, and they demonstrate that there are multiple ways to find a balance if conditions improve, the report says. If they don't improve, achieving a balance is much more difficult, and under critically dry futures, even large and unprecedented reductions may not be enough to stabilize the storage, it warns. Longtime Colorado-based water officials and consultant Jim Lockheed said that the federal alternative, the one that would be used only if the states can't agree in a plan, recognizes that it may be adequate to stabilize the river even in the short term, but it may be necessary for the feds to exercise their existing emergency authorities and seek additional authority, said Lockheed, who is the former Denver Water Director, who today represents several conservation groups involved in the negotiations from the outside. Eric Kuhn, a water researcher and former general manager of a Colorado water district, called the report's conclusions about the workability of some of its solutions very sobering. He said, for instance, that all but one of the alternatives would require granting states a waiver of some of their rights to water under the Colorado River Compact. That's because under some circumstances, the water that is released from Lake Powell to the lower basin states would be less than the compact's legal minimum releases. You're going to have to fix the problem in some way. The question is, can you do it without litigation, which would drag out a solution to the river's chronic supply-demand gap while its conditions keep deteriorating, Kuhn said. This is a very sobering analysis of the reality of what is going on with the river. Cynthia Campbell, head of an Arizona State University water research program, said that she was encouraged by the report's candor about the possibilities that one or more alternatives wouldn't preserve the river system and its reservoirs, and that at least some could lead to crashes in the system. But at the same time, she expressed major doubts that the lower basin states could alone shoulder the entire burden of the cuts that the new report says are needed. And that's been the central conflict between officials and the two basins throughout the negotiations. The phones at Sunnyside High School were ringing with calls from concerned parents on Thursday afternoon as false reports of immigration agents on the campus spread on social media, school officials said. In fact, Sunnyside High and Los Amigos Elementary went into a precautionary soft lockdown on Thursday, with the perimeter gates locked, but classes still in session, due to a nearby law enforcement operation on Tucson's south side. Immigration agents were never on the campus. Students were not at risk, said Maricela Felix, who is the school district spokesperson. The incident was one of several incorrect social media reports of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement activity in Tucson in the recent weeks. Amid the federal government's violent crackdown in Minneapolis and reports of an impending escalation of ICE enforcement in Phoenix, anxiety is surging among Tucson's immigrant and advocacy communities, advocates say. Some false rumors have circulated online, and there's been an increase in reports of ICE sightings. Some are valid and some are false alarms. To the local Rapid Response Network, which sends trained observers to bear witness to potential ICE threats. Local authorities say they're working to balance the need for an urgent response to good faith reports of ICE activity with making efforts to verify initial reports whenever possible. It's hard to say if there's been a true surge in ICE activity here this month or if heightened awareness is leading to more reports, some volunteers say. But likely it's both, said Sarah Roberts, who is an immigrant rights advocate and volunteer with Tucson's Coalición de Derechos Humanos, a human rights coalition. ICE is definitely active in Tucson, Roberts said, noting that the hotline got a call on Tuesday from a woman who said her husband has just been arrested by ICE and was seeking some legal help. Photos shared on Friday by a Facebook user showed three agents wearing green vests that say police/ICE at the Tucson Spectrum Shopping Center on West Irvington Road. The increase in rapid response reports indicates that there's heightened interest in protecting our neighbors, Roberts said, and that's a good thing. Immigration agents carry out arrests quickly and are often gone before observers with rapid response can arrive, and advocates don't want community members to hesitate to report ICE activity for fear of making an incorrect report. I'd rather falsely assume someone is ICE than falsely assume that they're not ICE, said Maggie Carswell, a Tucson community organizer. Still, there's real risk of burnout for activists and members of the immigrant community who are often in a sustained state of hypervigilance, Roberts said, and there's also a risk of secondary trauma from witnessing enforcement actions, she added. Sunnyside officials are encouraging members of the public to be prudent about what they share online, as unverified rumors can cause unnecessary stress and confusion. False rumors have been circulating on social media claiming that ICE was at Sunnyside High School. This is not true, Felix said in a Thursday email. We ask parents and our community to be part of the solution and to be aware of the serious consequences of resharing information on social media that is not reliable and from a verified source. It's 1:13. The U of A is launching an Institute for National Security that aims to translate research into solutions to safeguard U.S. national security interests and armed services personnel amid an increasingly complex geopolitical landscape. This is the U of A's second announcement related to national security in the span of a few days, coming Friday after its Wednesday news that is partnering with defense contractor Precise Systems, Inc., to compete for a share of up to $151 billion in contracts under Trump's Golden Dome missile defense program. The Kyle Institute for National Security, announced on Friday, will replace and expand on the U of A's Applied Research Corp, a nonprofit affiliated with the university since 2018, with the goal of facilitating strategic partnerships between the government, industry, and academia on national security and defense research. It will be named after U of A alumnus and Republican former U.S. Senator John Kyle, who represented Arizona in Congress for 26 years. Retired U.S. Air Force General Robin Rand will be president and CEO of the Institute. Rand had a 40-year military career, including 6 overseas assignments and 8 command tours. He will replace Austin Yamada, founding president and CEO of UAARC, who retired at the end of 2025 after a career that included 25 years as a senior citizen employee in the U.S. Defense Department. Rand said that while national security is a very broad issue, the U of A has shown strengths in that arena for decades, specifically in space operations, hypersonics, and directive energy. There's already a fair amount of research going on, he told the Star in an interview that was held on Friday. The Kyle Institute for National Security doesn't have these researchers. It is a facilitator, Rand said. It's an organization affiliated with the university, and its job is to connect U of A researchers, faculty, and students with external partners that are involved in national security who work in federal agencies or in the private industry. The Institute is home to a real diverse group of people, including military veterans and others who speak the language of the federal government agencies and the industry partners, he said. Their roles will include developing and writing proposals and drawing up contracts, while the researchers concentrate on the studies. The Kyle Institute for National Security provides the focus capacity for the University of Arizona to advance technologies and bring forward talent that elevate capability and create advantages for our federal and defense partners, as well as those in uniform, U of A President Suresh Garamella said in a news release on Friday. We are committed to following Senator Kyle's example of what it means to lead with clarity and principle as we advance our nation's defense readiness. Kyle said in the news release, it's especially meaningful to see the university apply its research strengths in partnership with the government and the private sector to address real-world security challenges. The announcement comes amid rapid geopolitical changes that are transforming national securities, said Tomas Diaz de la Rubia, who is the U of A Senior Vice President for Research and Partnerships, who will also be the board chair of the Kyle Institute. The Institute will apply the full weight of our research in space science, optical sciences and imaging, directed energy, hypersonics, material science, space domain awareness, and space systems engineering to develop solutions that advance our nation's security advantage, he said in a news release. The Arizona Board of Regents funded the Institute in part by providing seed funding for the U of A Strategic Research Initiative set in 2025 that focuses on national security and space issues. From Phoenix, Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs rolled out her executive proposal for the state budget on Friday, focusing on bread and butter affordability issues that she believes are critical for helping Arizonans and for helping her win a second term. But the $18.7 billion spending plan relies on a political sleight of hand and some good luck to be balanced, including leaning on Trump's administration to dole out nearly $760 million to reimburse the state for money it has spent on border security since 2021. To make the math work, she also relies on the Republican-controlled legislature to raise taxes, something they are politically opposed to, and to cut spending on the universal school voucher program that GOP lawmakers consider sacrosanct. The proposed tax increase includes a $146 million boost in levies on sports betting, which was legalized in 2021 and is currently taxed at 10% of the profits, as well as ending $38 million in yearly tax breaks that are handed out to new or expanding data centers. Together, the border reimbursements, tax increases, and voucher cuts add up to nearly $985 million, or about 5.5% of the proposed state budget. Not to worry, Hobbs spokesman Christian Slater said, at least on the border security money. He said Trump has made clear he's all in on border security as a top priority, and Hobbs and Republican Governor Doug Ducey spent that money securing the border. With Trump's one big, beautiful bill, including $13 billion for border states to spend on border security, the governor's office expects Arizona to get its share. We have bipartisan agreement among our Republican state legislatures, Governor Hobbs, Democratic state legislatures, that this is going to be something that we fight for, Slater said. And we feel very confident that we're going to be able to get that money. It may take some time. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security is charged with distributing the money to border states and has yet to come up with application rules. And Texas alone is asking for $11 billion of the $13 billion. The cuts to school vouchers, Hobbs wants to eliminate eligibility for the so-called empowerment scholarship accounts for those earning $250,000 a year or more. They are unlikely to come to pass. That change in eligibility would save the state $89 million. And then there's a proposal to boost taxes on the profits of firms that conduct sports betting from 10% to 45%, which will need at least some Republican support in order to become law. Tax increases generally require a two-thirds legislative vote, but Slater said that the governor's office believes the law legalizing sports betting allows changes with just a majority vote. Even that, however, would need some GOP support, since Republicans hold majorities in both the House and in the Senate. A number of teachers working with blind students at the Arizona State Schools for the Deaf and Blind's Tucson campus were notified on Friday that they were being laid off, according to sources with professional ties to the ASDB. Of those, teachers who are under contract were informed that they will no longer be employed after May, sources said, and will not be offered contracts for the following school year. Staff members who work with blind students who are notified that they're losing their jobs include teachers, instructional aides, and orientation and mobility specialists, sources have told the Arizona Daily Star. They were given the reasons, including budget cuts in the face of a deficit, as well as declining birth rate overall, sources said. It wasn't clear if any layoffs are affecting teachers working with deaf students at ASDB's Tucson campus. The reported layoffs follow ASDB's decision to close its West Speedway campus and move to the soon-to-be-vacant Copper Creek Elementary School in Oro Valley, one of four elementary schools that the Amphitheater Public Schools Governing Board voted this week to finalize closing. Tricia Beckham, public relations executive for the ASDB, declined to comment on Friday on reports of layoffs or teaching personnel, saying that it was an ongoing situation. A staff-wide meeting is scheduled for Monday from 3 p.m. to 4:30 p.m., and a community meeting has also been scheduled for Monday from 5:30 to 7 o'clock p.m. It will be held at the Career and Technical Education Building on its campus, which is located at 1200 West Speedway. It's unclear if cutbacks within its staff will affect how many students are served at the Copper Creek site. Asked, for instance, if all blind students will be transferred to the Copper Creek site, Beckham declined to comment, citing student privacy laws and the IEP, which stands for Individualized Education Program Law, that relates to the Federal Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which ensures that students with disabilities receive a free, appropriate public education. Beckham said ASDB alone doesn't make these decisions, and that IEP teams, comprising the school districts where the students' homes are located, as well as the children's parents, will make recommendations and must get parental approval for any of those decisions that are going to be made. She said there was no blanket decision made on taking or leaving all blind students as ASDB's Tucson branch moves its new Oro Valley campus, and didn't comment on any impacts on the deaf students. A lot of the tips media might be getting are not accurate, Beckham said. That's partly because people involved with ASDB aren't processing information well right now, which is understandable since it's a very difficult time, Beckham said. It isn't publicly known what will happen to transportation and residential staff at ASDB's Tucson campus, as it offers dormitory housing to students. The Tucson branch of ASDB has offered a day program for students who live at home or off campus, but also a residential program for students who come from around the state and live in campus dormitories. The main reasons ASDB will leave the current campus, which is located at 1200 West Speedway, and lease or sell it to a new user, is declining student enrollment and a goal of right-sizing the campus in order to meet students' needs. Albert Duff, director of Arizona State Schools for the Deaf and Blind, previously told the Star. About 120 students are enrolled at the Tucson campus, which is about 25% occupied, according to Duff. And since 1990, we've seen a decline in enrollment from 350 students now down to about 120 students, he said. As for the West Speedway campus, the key bullet points are antiquated facilities that at this point have an average age of 51 years. There's 31 buildings here. It's 346,000 square feet and only has 120 students, Duff said. ASDB, which is a state agency since Arizona's founding in 1912, has been housed at the West Speedway site since 1922. It's 1:25. The business news from this morning's Arizona Daily Star. Urban Communities, an Arizona-based real estate company, bought multifamily buildings in Detroit, leaving over a third of the neighborhood's apartment buildings in distress. A real estate gamble gone sideways has hollowed out more than a third of the apartment buildings in Palmer Park. Close to two dozen buildings in the neighborhood are practically abandoned, putting the viability of the neighborhood and its historic buildings at risk. Phoenix-based Urban Communities began buying multifamily buildings in the neighborhood near Detroit's northern border in 2020. Today, all 21 buildings are either in receivership, foreclosed, or highly distressed. Many are in dire physical condition. Wayne County tried to market five of the buildings the treasurer seized for unpaid taxes in a special auction that was held earlier this year. Listing photos and descriptions of the properties paint a grim picture. According to an inspection report of 361 Merton Road, the electrical wiring and much of the plumbing was stolen. Several units sustained fire damage, the stairs weren't secure, and paint and plaster were coming off the walls throughout the building. Getting this building back to an occupiable condition will be a significant undertaking, the report said. Not one of the properties elicited a single bid. Frank Simon, a court-appointed receiver tasked with marketing 14 of the buildings for sale, said that he inherited a tough situation. The portfolio definitely was not in good shape at all, he said. It was not managed well and had much deferred maintenance. Edward Lennon is the attorney for Urban Communities and its CEO, Maximiliano Palacio. In an emailed statement to the Outlier Media, Lennon blamed several factors for the company's downfall, including increased construction cost, nearby crime, and the 36th District Court's refusal to enforce evictions for non-payment. Other multifamily landlords have spoken about the challenges of Detroit's rental market. Urban Communities also had trouble getting renovations approved by the city's Historical District Commission. But the company's rapid collapse suggests that its move into Detroit real estate was mismanaged from the start. It had persistently high vacancy rates, mounting repair issues, and a trail of unpaid bills. The company stopped making payments on a mortgage just a few months after taking it out. Dayton Martindale rented an Urban Communities apartment for about 7 months starting in June of 2022. He experienced poor property management right from the start. Upon moving in, he discovered that his stove and oven were broken and immediately put in a work order. Despite visits to the front office and follow-up emails requesting service, which Martindale shared with Outlier, the repairs took more than a month. When he withheld the month's rent because he couldn't cook, the company filed for eviction. He paid the rent and continued living in the apartment. And then, months later, he came home one day to find that somebody had broken in and stolen his bicycle and other belongings. He said he called management right away to report the break-in and request that his door be repaired. They said they would send emergency maintenance, that was their phrase, to fix the doorknob, but it was never fixed, Martindale said. I moved out about a month later and I didn't have a working doorknob that whole time. Today, Urban Communities barely exist. The website is offline and email sent out to the general address just bounced back. Palmer Park is distinct in Detroit. The vast majority of the city's residential building stock is single-family homes, but the Palmer Park Historic District is almost exclusively apartment buildings, 57 of them, according to a report for Detroit's Historic District Commission. The neighborhood includes a wide variety of architectural styles, Moorish, Art Deco, Tudor Revival, Modern, spanning decades and built by some of Detroit's great architects, including Albert Kahn. The density, the diversity, and the beauty of Palmer Park's buildings are what make them a really one-of-a-kind collection that you don't see anywhere else in the city, said Detroit historian Amy Elliott Bragg. Bragg said it's important to protect this unique collection of buildings and worries how long-term abandonment affects the neighborhood. Each individual apartment building is historically and architecturally significant in its own way, she said. But the district as a whole also benefits from the density and the continuity of the neighborhood. Outlier pieced together the events that led to Urban Communities' downfall largely due through court records and filings at the Wayne County Register of Deeds. The company went on a buying spree starting in late 2020, scooping up all of the properties in its portfolio in about a year. It doesn't list purchase prices on the deeds that it filed, so it's unclear how much it paid in total, but it took out several mortgages. The company struggled from the outset to maintain its properties and pay the bills. Emma Greshek lived in her Urban Communities apartment for most of 2022. She said the building's back door wouldn't lock, numerous windows were broken, and both the heat and hot water heater went out within a week. You would see people with stuff crammed into their window like pillows, just any attempt to cover it, Greshek said. They didn't care about the tenants at all and didn't update the building. Urban Communities seemed to stop paying its bills in early 2023. Multiple contractors filed liens against the company for hundreds of thousands of dollars of unpaid work, including Genesee County-based Cardinal Roofing. Co-owner Susan Pierce said that her company did around 10 roofing jobs for Urban Communities under a $214,000 contract. And when the company stopped paying in May of 2023, Pierce said it still owed roughly half of that amount. We're a smaller company, Pierce said. My husband and I own it, and we have four salesmen and a crew for commercial work. So it was a huge hit for us. And then came the defaults. Urban Communities took out a $25 million loan on 15 properties in June of 2022. It missed its first payment just 9 months later. Court filings in Michigan's Third Circuit Court detailed the missing mortgage payments and other issues in a lawsuit between Urban Communities, its lender, and several trusts that transferred properties to the company in exchange for an ownership stake. Diversification matters, especially for regional economic growth. Regional economic success typically depends on leading industries that are anchored by major companies and organizations that attract multiple tiers of support businesses. In Tucson and southern Arizona, several bellwether industries drive the economy. Aerospace and defense, the Raytheon Systems and Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. In healthcare, Banner Medical Center and Tucson Medical Center. And in education, the University of Arizona and Pima Community College. Tourism, winter weather, Old West Heritage, the Gem Show, spas, resorts, and golf. Technology and innovation, IBM, the U of A, and the Tech Parks Arizona. It's time to add new industry sector to this list. Sports. The sports industry encompasses collegiate, professional, and youth sports. And while collegiate and professional sports are well established, Tucson is carving out a significant presence in the burgeoning youth sports sector, a $40 billion industry with considerable growth potential. The U of A has reached national prominence in college sports. Both the football and basketball programs compete at the highest level, and there are multiple national titles among several sports. Every December, Tucson hosts the Arizona Bowl, which is a major college football game that brings two different fan bases to the city, contributing significantly to the local economy and benefiting numerous charities. Tucson's professional sports landscape has always maintained a solid foundation. The city currently supports three professional teams: AHL Hockey Tucson Roadrunners, the IFL Football Tucson Sugar Skulls, and the USL League Two Soccer Teams FC Tucson. In 2025, Edmund Marquez and a group of business leaders purchased the Tucson Sugar Skulls. And there are three premier assets. The Keno Sports Complex is an expansive facility on Tucson's south side that's divided into three areas. The main complex features a Major League Baseball stadium seating for 11,000. The North Complex serves soccer with eight fields and two lighted softball fields. The South Complex opened in 2020 on 167 acres with 12 lighted natural grass multipurposes for rugby, football, soccer, lacrosse, and other sports. The newest addition to Tucson's sport infrastructure is the Mosaic Quarter, a $425 million multi-venue complex that is scheduled to open in 2027. This ambitious project will serve as a hub of youth sports activity for years to come. The first phase includes the 175,000-square-foot MQ Iceplex and the 131,000-square-foot MQ Field House. Successive phases will add the MQ Sportsplex and the MQ Pavilion. The size and flexibility of these facilities enable Mosaic Quarter to serve a wide variety of youth sports teams and leagues, and by the time the project is complete, you could find any of the following sports conducting regional, statewide, and national competitions: archery, badminton, basketball, cheerleading, curling, dance, ice skating, football, futsal, hockey, judo, lacrosse, pickleball, soccer, track and field, volleyball, and wrestling. Taking a look at letters to the editor, if Congress can afford to fund ICE, it can afford to support the ACA. One is important, the other is not, especially since it is acting illegally to satisfy Trump. As an American, I oppose any increased funding for ICE or Border Patrol. Attacking blue states simply because Trump canon is moral and most likely unconstitutional. Mass federal agents have been running rampant in our cities, brutalizing our communities, tearing families apart, and even killing residents. The recent killing of Renee Good is just one story among many highlighting ICE and the Trump administration's illegal violence that allows agents to operate with full impunity. ICE now has the largest budget of any federal law enforcement agency. One illness can wipe out a family. One death can wipe out a family. And that just doesn't seem right in this country that's supposed to be the best country in the world. From the East Side, that was written by Peter Bishop. Herbert Schneidau from the Foothills writes, "All human beings in the Western Hemisphere are either migrants or descendants of migrants. Even the Native Americans came over from Siberia. Trump had the idiotic idea that the real Americans should have pure white blood. The force he is using to achieve this consists of trigger-happy thugs, led by a woman who ought to be in jail for cruelty to animals. He chooses for eye candy so he can recall reporters Piggy, etc. Trump's goons ought to find honest work. Jesse Ventura for governor of Minnesota is a step in the right direction. Another would be disarming ICE. If there is a hell, a large part is no doubt is reserved for Hitler and other racist murderers. Think about this, Donald. Before you send in troops with instructions to aim at the knees of protesters, another dopey idea he floated in his first term." Sister Karen Berry from Midtown writes, "On January 13th, I attended the town hall offered by our Attorney General, seeking input from customers of TEP regarding their proposed rate hike. One participant suggested that the Arizona Corporation Commission, the ACC, be renamed the Public Utilities Commission, since that's what it is. Renaming it might encourage voters to become more informed about people running for election to this commission. Our state is the only one which has commission both in its constitution and its members are elected rather than appointed. Article 15, which created it, took more time and thought than any other article in our Constitution. It's very important and very powerful. Recent membership has turned more towards satisfying corporations than protecting the customers with regard to costs and services. That was not the article's original intent. As stated by Sheldon Clark in his January 16th guest column, a board of ACC commissioners beholden to ratepayers would be a nice change in November." Tom Henderson from the West Side writes, "Our president says he doesn't like wind turbines because they kill birds, but he doesn't seem at all concerned that his sycophantic witch doctor Robert Kennedy's proposed vaccine standards have the potential to kill thousands of American school children. What's wrong with this picture?" Steve McGelly from the Northwest Side, Is it just me, or has anybody noticed that the pavement on many of the city's primary streets is in such poor condition as to be dangerous to drive on, but they apparently have no money available to repair or repave any portions of them? However, they seem to have unlimited funds and time available to remove and replace perfectly serviceable wheelchair ramps all along many of these same roadways. What is there more of using your thoroughfares, motor vehicles, or disabled pedestrians? Tim Canny from Oracle. These are tough days for every one of us, civilians and ICE agents alike. The picture on the front page of Friday's newspaper was taken locally. It shows an agent and a protester. The agent is swaddled head to toe in tactical gear and packing. It also shows his personal choice of handwear, a pair of gloves, making his hands appear to be those of a skeleton. What would a psych test say about someone who feels the need to top off all of his armor and weapons with these gloves? And let's see here, Gail Schumacher from the Southwest Side. Am I the only one who sees through the outright hypocrisy of the U.S. president who encourages protesters in Iran but sends more troops to Minneapolis to quell the protesters there? While Iran has a record of suppressing protesters over several decades, the United States is now not far behind in its intolerance to people who resist against ICE, as well as the damaging policies of the current administration in cutting health benefits and other social programs to transfer money to the military and to ICE. The president has proven himself to be a fascist leader with every new executive order. On January 20th, there will be national marches, including here in Tucson, to Free America walkout against fascism and towards freedom. For more information, visit act.womensmarch.com to find an event that you can participate in. In National World News at 20 till, from Cape Canaveral, Florida, NASA's giant new moon rocket moved to the launch pad yesterday in preparation for the astronauts' first lunar fly-around in more than half of a century. The out-and-back trip could blast off as early as February. The 322-foot rocket began its 1 mile-per-hour creep from Kennedy Space Center's Vehicle Assembly Building at daybreak. The 4 mile trek took until nightfall. Thousands of Space Center workers and their families gathered in the pre-dawn chill to witness the long-awaited event, delayed for years. They huddled together ahead of the Space Launch System rocket's exit from the building, built in the 1960s to accommodate the Saturn V rockets that sent 24 astronauts to the moon during the Apollo program. The cheering crowd was led by NASA's new administrator, Jared Isaacman, and all four astronauts that are assigned to the mission. "What a great day to be here," said Reid Weissman, the crew commander. "It is awe-inspiring." Weighing 11 million pounds, the Space Launch System rocket and Orion crew capsule on top made the move aboard a massive transporter used during the Apollo and Shuttle eras. It was upgraded for the SLS rocket's extra heft. The first and only other SLS launch, which sent an empty Orion capsule into orbit around the moon, took place back in November of 2022. "This one feels a lot different, putting crew on the rocket and taking a crew around the moon," said NASA's John Honeycutt on the eve of the rocket's rollout. Heat shield damage and other capsule programs during the initial test flight required extensive analysis and tests, pushing back this first crew moonshot until now. "The astronauts won't orbit the moon or even land on it. That giant leap will come in the third flight of the Artemis lineup just a few years from now." Weissman, pilot Victor Glover, and Christina Koch, longtime NASA astronauts with spaceflight experience, will be joined on the 10-day mission by Canadian astronaut Jeremy Hansen, a former fighter pilot who's awaiting his first rocket ride. They will be the first people to fly to the moon since Apollo 17's Gene Cernan and Harrison Schmitt closed out the triumphant lunar landing program in 1972. NASA will conduct a fueling test of the SLS rocket on the pad in early February before confirming a launch date. And the short stuff from the Digest from Washington. A third round of U.S. retaliatory strikes in Syria resulted in the death of an al-Qaeda-affiliated leader, whose officials say had a direct tie to the Islamic State member responsible for last month's ambush that killed two U.S. soldiers and one American civilian interpreter in the country. U.S. Central Command announced Friday's strike in northwest Syria killed Bilal Hassan al-Jassim, an experienced terrorist leader who plotted attacks and was directly connected to the December 13th attack that killed Sergeant Edgar Brian Torres Tovar, Sergeant William Nathaniel Howard, and interpreter Ayad Mansour Sakat. The strike was part of a broader U.S. operation Trump ordered following the ambush of the Americans to target ISIS thugs trying to regroup after the ouster of autocratic leader Bashar Assad just a year ago. From New York, a week after Trump told the credit card industry it had until January 20th to comply with his command for a 10% cap on interest rates, consumer groups, politicians, and bankers alike remained unclear on what the White House planned and whether Trump was serious about the idea. So far, the White House hasn't provided any detail about what will happen to credit card companies that don't lower card rates. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said the president has an expectation that credit card companies will accede to his demand that they cap interest rates on credit cards at 10%. "I don't have a specific consequence to outline for you," she said on Friday. Researchers found Americans would save about $100 billion in interest a year if the rates were capped at 10%. They found the credit card industry would still be profitable, though credit card rewards and other perks might be scaled back. Very briefly, a Ukrainian delegation arrived in the United States for talks yesterday on a U.S.-led diplomatic push to end the nearly four-year-old war as Russian attacks again took aim at Ukraine's power grid, cutting electricity and heating in freezing temperatures. The European Union and Mercosur bloc of South American countries formally signed a long-sought landmark free trade agreement on Saturday amid rising protectionism and trade tensions around the world. From Iraq, the last U.S. military personnel fully withdrew from an airbase in western Iraq under a 2024 agreement with the Iraqi government, Iraqi officials said yesterday. An ATR-42-500 passenger aircraft carrying 11 people lost contact with the ground yesterday while approaching a mountainous region between Indonesia's main island of Java and Sulawesi Island, according to officials. From Uganda, President Yoweri Museveni won his seventh term in Uganda with 71.65% of the vote. This according to official results on Saturday, in an election marred by internet shutdown and fraud claims by his youthful challenger, Bobi Wine, who rejected the outcome and called for a peaceful protest. And from Syria, Syrian government forces entered two northern towns Saturday morning after the command of Kurdish-led fighters said it would evacuate the area in an apparent move to avoid conflict. From Dubai in the UAE, Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei branded U.S. President Trump a criminal Saturday for supporting protests in Iran and blamed demonstrators for causing thousands of deaths. In a speech broadcast by state television, Khamenei said that the protests left several thousand people dead, the first indication from an Iranian leader of the extent of the casualties. In this revolt, the U.S. president made remarks in person, encouraged seditious people to go ahead, and said, "We do support you, we do support you militarily," said Khamenei, who has final say on all state matters. He reiterated an accusation that the United States seeks dominance over Iran's economic and political resources. In response, Trump, in an interview Saturday with Politico, called for an end to Khamenei's nearly 40-year reign. A day earlier, Trump said that Iran canceled the hanging of over 800 people, a sign he backed away from a military strike, but didn't clarify whom he spoke to in Iran. The official IRNA news agency reported that Tehran Prosecutor General Ali Salehi said that Trump always makes futile and irrelevant statements. "Our attitude is severe, preventive, and fast." The protests began on December 28 over Iran's ailing economy and collapse of its currency. Iran returned to an uneasy calm after the crackdown, which left at least 3,308 people dead, according to the U.S.-based human rights activist news agency. Text messaging and very limited internet services began functioning again, briefly yesterday in parts of Iran. From Minneapolis, demonstrators for and against Trump's administration immigration crackdown clashed again on Saturday in Minneapolis as the governor's office announced that the National Guard troops were mobilized. There have been protests every day since the Department of Homeland Security ramped up immigration enforcement in the twin cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul by bringing in more than 2,000 federal officers. A large group of protesters turned out in downtown Minneapolis and confronted a much smaller group of people attending an anti-Somali and pro-immigration and customs enforcement rally. They chased the two pro-ICE group away and forced at least one member to take off a shirt that they deemed objectionable. Jake Lang, who organized the anti-Islam and pro-ICE demonstration, appeared to be injured as he left the scene, with bruises and scrapes on his head. He said via social media beforehand that he intended to burn a Quran on the steps of City Hall, but was not clear if he had carried out that plan. Lang previously was charged with assaulting an officer with a baseball bat, civil disorder, and other crimes before receiving clemency in Trump's sweeping act of clemency for January 6 of 2021, capital riot defendants last year. Lang recently announced he's running for the U.S. Senate in Florida. Today in history, in 1778, English navigator Captain James Cook reached the present-day Hawaiian Islands, which he dubbed the Sandwich Islands. In 1803, President Thomas Jefferson asked Congress in a confidential message for $2,500 in funding for exploration of western lands all the way to the Pacific, an early step in the eventual formation of the Lewis and Clark Expedition that would ultimately accelerate American expansion westward beyond the Mississippi River. In 1911, the first landing of an aircraft on a ship took place as pilot Eugene B. Ely brought his Curtiss biplane in for a safe landing on the deck of the armored cruiser USS Pennsylvania in San Francisco Harbor. In 1958, Canadian Willie O'Ree became the first black player in National Hockey League as he made his debut with the Boston Bruins. In 1977, scientists identified the bacteria responsible for the deadly form of atypical pneumonia known as Legionnaire's disease. And in 1990, Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry was arrested after he was caught smoking crack cocaine in a videotape string. Barry, a few months later, was in prison, won a D.C. seat in 1992 and a fourth mayoral victory in 1994. And in sports, the Super Bowl winning coach Tony Dungy is coming to Tucson. He's a Pro Football Hall of Famer, an NBC broadcaster and author, and he'll be the guest speaker in the annual Fireside Chat series hosted by Arizona basketball legend Bob Elliott. The Fireside Chat is organized by the African American Museum of Southern Arizona, which is located on the U of A campus, and co-founded by Elliott and his wife Beverly. The museum first opened as doors just over 3 years ago, and since then, over 10,000 visitors have come through the doors. The community support has been unbelievable, Elliott said. Dungy's Fireside Chat will be in the Palo Verde High School Auditorium, and that is located at 1302 South Avenida Vega on February 18th during Black History Month. Members of the African American Museum of Southern Arizona will receive priority seating. More information about the event can be found at aamsaz.org, aamsaz.org. Flag football is taking the next step toward becoming an official NCAA sport. At the annual NCAA convention in Washington, D.C. on January 14th, the Division I cabinet approved the addition of flag football to the Emerging Sports for Women program. This comes as several schools across the NCAA have added flag football as a women's varsity sport in recent years. The approval follows the NCAA Committee on Women's Athletics recommendation in February of 2025 that Divisions 1, 2, and 3 sponsor legislation to add flag football to the NCAA Emerging Sports for Women program. The sport will make its Olympic debut in 2028. Quick look at the NFL playoffs. Yesterday, Buffalo visited Denver. Denver won that one 33-30 and in a very exciting game. And Seattle beat San Francisco and almost routed them. Today, it's Houston at New England at 1 o'clock p.m. on ABC and the Rams at Chicago this afternoon at 4:30 p.m. on NBC. And from Denver, Jaquan McMillan intercepted Josh Allen's deep throw in overtime. Bo Nix led the Broncos into position for Will Lutz's 23-yard field goal that sent the Broncos to the AFC Championship game with a 33-30 win over Buffalo on Saturday. McMillan's pick was Denver's fifth takeaway of the game. The Broncos went into the playoffs at -3 in turnover differential. McMillan wrestled the ball away from Brandon Cooks at the Broncos' 20-yard line when a field goal would have won the game for Buffalo. The Broncos, who are 15-3, will face either New England or Houston for the AFC title next Sunday at Empower Field at Mile High in Denver, where top-seeded the Broncos have won 14 of its past 15 games. "We really played a good game and a good team," Nixon said. "They played really well tonight. They gave us a great shot in a short week after a tough game last week, so hats off to them. We found a way to win again with our defense, made stops, and I'm just proud of our guys. I'm just proud of this organization, and I'm proud of the way we compete and the way we fight. We're just never out of it, and I think that the character piece, that's a part of it. We aren't always pretty, and a good lead, they came back, and I wasn't looking good, but in the fourth quarter and overtime, we found a way to win." The Broncos coach Sean Payton lamented Denver's sputtering offense and 1-for-4 performance in the red zone. "We were good in the red zone, but we were good enough when it mattered." The Bills, who were 13-6, were flagged for pass interference twice. Bo Nix broke his right ankle in the overtime and will have surgery that'll sideline him for the rest of the playoffs. Payton delivered the stunning news about his second-year quarterback in the aftermath of Denver's biggest win in a decade. Backup quarterback Jarrett Stidham will start the AFC Championship game next weekend. "Stiddy's ready," Payton said, after returning to the post-game lectern to discuss the injury. He said Nix got hurt on a keeper when he lost 2 yards and was tackled by safety Cole Bishop. Nix was limping after the play, but there is no indication that he suffered such a serious injury. And from Seattle, Rashid Shaheed returned the opening kickoff for a touchdown. Kenneth Walker III rushed for 3 scores. And the Seattle Seahawks advanced to the NFC Championship with a dominant 41-6 victory over the 49ers last night. Sam Darnold threw a touchdown pass and got his first career playoff win in his first season with the Seahawks, who are 15-3. And they will host either the Chicago Bears or the Rams next Sunday with the trip to the Super Bowl at stake. That's the reading of the Arizona Daily Star for Sunday the 18th. Mark DeGroft with you, wishing you a very good rest of your weekend and an even better week next week. Till then, take care.